What I'd like to do in this session is begin to look at how to establish the view of reality. So that is the basis of our Vipassana practice. And what I'd like to begin with is to look briefly at the Vipassana practice within the Theravada vehicle, meaning to look at these three insights and how to go about cultivating them. And then on that basis, we'll then, for the rest of the day, look at how to establish this view of emptiness and how to go about meditating and cultivating that. But very briefly here to begin with, and I think some of this is a little bit obvious, but we'll look at it anyway, is remember in the Theravada vehicles, to achieve the goal of nirvana, we need to gain these three insights into reality called the three marks of existence. And the three insights we need to cultivate in Vipassana practice is an insight into impermanence, an insight into dukkha, the nature of our existence, and an insight into the fact that there's no self, no autonomous me. So let's have a look at each of those three in a little bit more detail. So the first one, this insight into impermanence, in Pali it's anicca, and in Sanskrit anitya. So Pali was used as the basis of the modern-day Theravada vehicles, and Sanskrit is the original language, is the basis of the Mahayana traditions. So, again, impermanence here is simply the realization that things are changing moment by moment. Intellectually, I think, again, we all accept that. So it's not like we have to somehow go through some intellectual process to come to intellectually accept that fact, because science has proven it conclusively. We learned it at school. So intellectually, I think none of us have any problem accepting this. But of course, here in the Vipassana practice, it's not a matter of intellectually accepting these points. Because, again, it's our behaviour is driven by our instinctive habit. We need to change our instinctive habit. So what we need to do with each of these three is not just intellectually understand and accept, but to bring that understanding into experience. We need to experientially see things in this way. So with impermanence, then, we need to meditate on impermanence and not just accept it intellectually, so that we can then experientially see things in this way. In fact, we can, in terms of our practice, we can talk about going through three stages. And I like to use the Tibetan words here because they're very short. Go nyam tok. So these are three stages we go through in our practice. The first stage, go in Tibetan, means intellectual. So first stage, of course, is to come to an intellectual understanding about, in this case, impermanence, but in emptiness and so forth. So we need to reflect on these things to come to intellectually understand these points in the nature of reality. But again, then we use that intellectual framework as the basis of meditation and come to experience here, in this case, impermanence in meditation. And that is nyam. Nyam means taste or experience. So if we sit down and meditate on the idea of impermanence and we come to have an experience in meditation that things are changing moment by moment, then that experience of impermanence in meditation, after the meditation, if our mind was very stable and clear, that experience could have had some profound impact on our mind, so that even after the meditation, it's still affecting our mind. So if we were meditating on impermanence and we had some really deep insight into it, maybe when we get up from the meditation and we look around, things don't seem so static and stable. They seem to be flowing more. And that experience may last for some minutes, hours, days, or even longer. But then eventually our old habits will start to reassert themselves and we're going to experientially see things as very stable and static. But during the time where we experientially see things as more in a flow state, then we're in harmony with reality. And you'll find that you'll have less mental afflictions and less reaction. You'll be more in harmony with things around us. You'll find you'll be more at peace and so forth. But that'll wear off and then you'll go back to our normal reactory ways and so forth. So that's nyam. So what we want to do is we want to stabilize that experience so it's longer lasting. That's tok. Means in English, realization. To go from nyam to tok, of course, we need a very stable and clear mind. That's why if we looked in our three vehicles chart, we saw that the three core areas of practice, the Eightfold Path, we can condense it to ethics, concentration, wisdom. So ethics, of course, is the foundation. Concentration, sometimes in particularly Mahayana traditions, is called shamatha practice, is to develop a calm, clear, focused mind. And on that basis, we do wisdom practice, vipassana practice. So if we put effort into our shamatha practice, i.e. just developing a calm, clear, focused mind, we have that as the basis of vipassana practice, then this can go to this. We can only get realization if we have that calm, clear, focused mind, the mind of shamatha. That's why the concentration practice is essential. All Buddhist traditions acknowledge that it's one of the core, three core practices. But unfortunately, if you look at most modern-day Buddhist traditions and you look at what they're doing, this concentration or shamatha practice seems to get left out. You know, in the Theravada traditions, it's all vipassana, vipassana, vipassana. In the Mahayana, in the Tibetan tradition, bodhicitta, emptiness, deity yoga, let's go. And so, of course, people put a lot of effort into these practices and they don't get anywhere because their mind is distracted and dull. So if we don't put effort into shamatha practice, we're probably not even going to get to this stage. We're probably not even going to have any experience of bodhicitta or anything because we're trying to do our practice and we're all over the place. Nothing will penetrate. If we do shamatha practice, if we really develop a calm, clear mind, we're going to start to have some taste and experience of vipassana, of bodhicitta, of compassion, of emptiness. We're going to start to experience that because we'll be focused in our meditation. And then if we really put a lot of effort into shamatha practice, we're going to get the stage of realization where those experiences will stay with us. And so we need to get here. So therefore, it's very important in our vipassana practice that we have a basis of shamatha, developing this calm, clear mind. So here in terms of impermanence, if we can really meditate on that with a very calm, clear mind, we can really experientially come to see things as in a changing moment by moment. And you'll find that just that, if we can get just to the nyam state of having some taste or experience of emptiness of impermanence in meditation, and that's affecting us a little bit after, you'll find your life will already be dramatically improved. You'll find your mind will be more calm, you'll be in more harmony, you won't have so much craving and aversion. Already that's much improved. And what we're going to see as well, if we come to realize really impermanence, what that really means is very close to emptiness, very close. So if we really appreciate impermanence at the most subtle level, we're nearly realizing emptiness, very close. So this is a very good basis for the emptiness practice. Then dukkha, the second insight here, is basically to realize the nature of our the our existence. Our existence, our experiences are in a state of dukkha. So here, of course, we're talking about the first noble truth the Buddha taught, that what is the state we find ourselves in now is dukkha. Unfortunately, this is often translated into English as suffering. The problem with that is that we don't understand then what the word dukkha means, because the first noble truth, often people say, according to Buddhism, truth of suffering. Everything's suffering. But what does the word dukkha mean? We can talk about three levels or type of dukkha. The first is called the dukkha of suffering. And this is actually talking about our unpleasant experiences. So this is what we normally relate to with the word suffering. Any sort of painful, unpleasant, physical or mental experience. And this type of experience is pretty obvious to all of us that it's unsatisfactory. It's not something we want. So this, we don't have to reflect too much about. We sort of know that it's not satisfactory. Then the second level or type is the dukkha of change. And here the Buddha was describing our pleasant experiences. Normally, we identify our pleasant experiences as happiness. And so what we do is, of course, we try to hold on to them, grasp on to pleasant experiences. But here, the Buddha was trying to highlight what is the very nature of our pleasant experiences. And he used the word change to highlight that, meaning they change, they come to an end. That every single pleasant experience we've ever had, are having, will have, will come to an end because they're stimulus-based experiences. Not only that, but we are to understand that our pleasant experiences are not in the nature of happiness. As we saw before, earlier today, that if they were in the nature of happiness, it means the more pleasant experience we had, the more happy we should become. But if we overindulge in some pleasant experience of eating food or sitting in the sun, we don't become more happy, we end up with suffering. So here we are also to understand that our pleasant experiences are not in the nature of happiness, they're relative experience. Relative to some earlier state, it's an improvement. But if we overindulge in them, then often they turn into suffering themselves. And so by understanding this about our pleasant experiences, we won't grasp onto them hoping that they're going to satisfy us, hoping that they'll last, because that's futile. It's just going to create a lot of agitation and unnecessary suffering. So if we realize pleasant experiences as simply transient, temporary, pleasant experiences, we can enjoy them while they're there and not confuse them and think that they're going to satisfy us and hope that they last forever. So that's what we're trying to understand here. Again, intellectually, we may appreciate that. Experientially, that's not how we behave. So if we meditate on this and experientially come to realize this, then in daily life, we can simply enjoy pleasant experiences and not grasp onto them and hope that they're going to satisfy us. But at the deepest level, we're trying to realize what's called all-pervasive dukkha. And all-pervasive dukkha here means that the very nature of our existence is that there's always a potential for some sort of suffering to arise in our life. We can't go anywhere or be anywhere to be free of the potential of suffering. Given certain conditions coming together, suffering can arise. So that's what we're trying to realize here. And to really realize this, we have to really understand the second noble truth. Where is our suffering coming from? It's coming from the mental afflictions in our mind. So this is what all-pervasive dukkha is the realization of, is to realize that as long as we have mental afflictions and ignorance in our mind, we're stuck. And if we realize that, then we're going to stop looking for happiness out there and look inside of ourselves. So if we can really realize this second insight into dukkha, we're going to develop renunciation. So impermanence will help support this. If we realize dukkha, we're going to develop an aspiration to be liberated from suffering, knowing that the source of suffering is inside ourselves. So that is the second insight we're trying to develop. We develop that, this becomes more or less automatic. Once we have that, we have to strive for nirvana. How to get to nirvana? We need to realize this, no self. So here, what do we mean by no self? The word self in Sanskrit is Atman. So here the distortion is that we overinflate the sense of me. And we can overinflate the sense of me in a number of ways and levels. But the one we're talking about here in the three marks of existence is that we believe in this autonomous me. And the technical word for that is we grasp onto and believe in a self-sufficient, substantially existent me. Self-sufficient here means existing within itself, not really seeming to rely on anything else to exist, and substantially existence means it's really something solid and substantial. We have this false sense of me instinctively, and it's reflected a lot in our language, the way we speak. For example, you know, often we say, I have a body, I have a mind, as if there's a third thing, something other than the body and the mind, this me that has a body and has a mind. That's how we speak and behave, as if somewhere here there's something more than a body and mind. There's a third thing and something extra, the me that is the owner or controller of this body and mind. So sometimes this false sense of me is called the idea of a master or controller. That we really instinctively have a sense that somewhere here there is a me who's trying to run the show. There's a me here who owns this body or has this body, and a me who has this mind, and this me seems to be something more, something a little bit separate from the body and the mind, but somehow still somewhere here. So this is the false sense of me that we relate to, identify with, and it's the basis of a lot of our behavior. Another example here is that, you know, sometimes we may have the thought, we look at our body, we don't like what we see, and sometimes we even have a thought, oof, I'd like to swap this body for a younger, more healthy, more beautiful body. You know, sometimes we have this thought, yeah? And then sometimes we look at our mind and it's a mess, you know, neurotic, chaotic, and we go, oh, I'd like to swap this mind for a more intelligent, more kind, more loving mind. We have these thoughts. But where is the me that could do that swap? Because if we take out this body and mind, what's left? Is there a me that could do the swap? Is there? So intellectually, again, we may appreciate, yes, there's really just a body and a mind here, but that's not how we behave. We really behave as if somehow there's a me here that exists in this way that's trying to run the show. And this doesn't exist. And because we believe in it, we have mental afflictions and suffering. That's the Buddhist assertion. So in the Theravada traditions, if we come to realize there's no such self, we do not exist like this, we can overcome fundamental ignorance, mental afflictions, we can achieve nirvana. So this is the deepest level of insight, Vipassana practice that we're trying to cultivate in the Theravada traditions. Any questions on this or the other two? So any questions on this three marks of existence?
Yeah.
This insight. Yeah.
When you said that we naturally develop a desire for renunciation when we realise that they're the result of basic suffering, is that we're giving up dukkha then, aren't we?
What we're doing is... Yeah, I mean, here we already move away from this because we know this is unsatisfactory. So we don't really have to think too much about this. Here is where a lot of people go wrong. They're moving away from this, but they think pleasant experiences is the answer. Let's have more pleasant experiences that'll fulfill my life. But this is futile. No? We're never going to have a fulfilling life chasing after pleasant experiences. So if we reflect on that, we can let go of that idea and simply enjoy unpleasant experiences. But then if we look here and understand that why are we stuck in this unsatisfactory state, it's because of the mental afflictions in our mind. If we really realise this, we're going to stop looking anywhere out here for fulfilling happiness. We're going to understand it's coming within. And that is going to lead to the aspiration to fix the mental afflictions in our mind. So that aspiration for liberation is coming from really realizing this. So by just realizing this, maybe it'll reduce our craving and attachment for pleasant things, but we're still stuck. Often what happens is if people don't go here, and they realize that pleasant things are never going to fulfill them, what happens is they become completely dejected. Nothing can satisfy me because I can see that this stuff is not going to satisfy. And so they end up in depression. No? Because nothing there is going to satisfy me in my life. You get stuck. And so therefore, you know, if you do mindfulness purely, you may come to realize this because through mindfulness you can see these pleasant experiences of rising, passing, which stops grasping at them. But then from that we may think, well, nothing's going to satisfy me, and then become completely depressed. That's why you need more than just mindfulness. Because if you then reflect on this, you'll understand actually genuine happiness can be attained, but not out there, in here. So by reflecting on this, we'll develop that aspiration. So that's why it's important. This basically is starting to reflect on the second noble truth as well. The idea that it's our ignorance and mental afflictions. You know, our original diagram here. I mean, basically it's to understand this, isn't it? All pervasive. If we understand that this unsatisfactory state is coming from our mental afflictions and this, and this is something that we can actually eliminate, then we're going to think, wow, I can really achieve a state of genuine happiness if I reduce and eliminate this. And then you'll develop that aspiration for that. So that's why it's important. See, that's why it's important in the three marks of existence to realize this. Because if you don't realize this, you're not going to put any effort into this. Because if you don't realize this, we're still going to be chasing after happiness out there. And people go, oh, I like to meditate, but I don't have time. You know, I have to get all this stuff. You know, I need to do more work to get a bigger car, bigger house. I need all this stuff. I don't have time to meditate. Why? Because they still believe that stuff is going to satisfy them. They haven't realized this. If you realize this, you'll understand that chasing after more money, more pleasure, more stuff is futile. But if you don't realize the deepest level, then you may just become depressed. You know, oh, nothing's going to satisfy me because I can see none of this, and we don't see any other option. It's this or nothing. Because we only identify pleasure with happiness. We don't understand this genuine happiness in Buddhism, this idea that you can have a state of well-being that does not require any stimulus, particular stimulus, to be present. That's why it's important to reflect on this in terms of the second noble truth, to understand that if we eliminate this mental afflictions and ignorance in our mind, we can achieve a state of genuine happiness, a state of well-being that is there 24/7, that doesn't require any of those stimulus to be there. If we realise that, then we're going to have an aspiration to strive for that.
Is that a permanent?
Yes. Because once you've eliminated the impurity in your mind, it can't come back because there's no cause anymore. So once we achieve the goal of Nirvana enlightenment, it's a one-way ticket. You can't fall back. Well, the stains is what's stopping us from Nirvana to enlightenment. But if you achieve Nirvana, that's it. No more mental afflictions or suffering. The stains are still there, but they're not causing any problems in terms of mental afflictions or suffering.
Right. So they're not obscurations, they're not impediments to happiness and well-being.
They're cognitive obscurations. They're impediments to enlightenment. Because it's in the enlightened state that we can really benefit others. So they're impediments to enlightenment, but there wouldn't be an impediment to a state of genuine happiness.
Given what you said about shamatha, it's surprising in a way that it's not taught more and it's not emphasised more. It is in certain places, I know, but it's really good.
Yeah, I find it astonishing as well, because, see, the thing is that each of the different traditions has their perspective of the spiritual path. And if you look in all the traditions, they'll all talk about concentration practice, samadhi practice, shamatha practice. I mean, if you look like, you know, this centre's part of the FPMT, Galuk, and you look at the Lam Rim, you know, three huge volumes, the third volume, half of that or big part of that is shamatha practice. But then when you look at what people are doing, who's doing it? Who's practicing? Oh no, I got to do my bodhicitta and emptiness and deity yoga, and I got to do my other, you know, precious human life and stuff. And they put a lot of effort into that, but then, you know, years later, not much has changed. Why? Because they're trying to do their meditation and they're thinking about work and they're half asleep, and so nothing. So basically, we don't go from here to here. I mean, you don't go from here to here. It just stays intellectual. Yes, maybe after 10 years, you're very smart. You know all the right words and you can parrot off about emptiness and bodhicitta and deity yoga and how the visualization works, and you're expert in that, but you're still miserable. No? Yeah, because we haven't gone from here to here. I mean, we haven't gone from here to here. I mean, you know, you can be the smartest Buddhist in the world and be miserable. No?
So, I mean, is the shamatha practice, one of the things that I've heard over and over again is that, yes, shamatha is all real. You have to go away for 6 months and do that, or however many years, and it's too difficult. You can't do it on a daily basis. I mean,
so,
is that the case? Or?
Yeah, so, of course, we need to work at our level of capacity. Mm-hmm. Yeah? But what you'll find is that as we practice, our priorities change, our capacity changes, and so forth. So, you know, often people see this point. You know, if we really want to achieve shamatha, we have to put a huge commitment in, and then they go, oh, I can't do that, and they don't even bother. And, of course, if you don't bother doing anything, you're not going to get anywhere. So at whatever level of ability we can manage, we'll benefit at that level. And then the more we do, the better we become. It's like Shantideva, a great Indian master. He says, no matter how difficult something seems, everything with practice becomes easy. And it's true. We just got to practice at whatever level we can manage now.
So even a short daily practice would build up.
Yes. I mean, when you look in the shamatha practice and there's a classic diagram of the 9 stages and then you look at all that and you go, oh, no, that's impossible. You know, it's like, let's say you wanted to be a concert pianist and then you look at how many thousands of hours of practice, you go, oh, no, that's impossible. And you don't even start to do any practice. Well, of course, you're not going to be able to even play the basic piano if you don't start something. But maybe if you started something and do what you can and you got to a certain level, then maybe things change and then you can do more and more. But whatever you do is benefit. So it's not like if I don't get to shamatha, I get zero benefit. It's not like that. I mean, if we get part a little bit of the way there, we'll benefit. And all the other practices will benefit. So it's not like, oh, that's too difficult, I won't bother. I mean, that's really a bit silly to have that idea because, you know, it's not like we get zero benefit until we get there. I mean, any progress we make will benefit. So we do what we can, you know?
When you read that list of prerequisites for shamatha, they seem pretty much to be saying you've got, I think there's one that says not to have a busy life. Or, you know, there's all those sort of things that make you think, well, actually, you do have to go off to eventually to a cave.
Right, but that's the thing, is that it all comes down to priorities, you know. And people say, oh, I'm too busy, you know, I've got all these things to do. I mean, the reality, of course, is we have busy lives in our modern world, but at some level there's a choice, you know. Of course, if you've got children and commitments and so forth, you use certain financial constraints, and you've got to look after the family, okay. But what we find, of course, is above and beyond those basic essential requirements, we fill up our life with a lot of stuff. And, of course, with that, we're not going to be able to devote to any of this, for sure. But that's just a matter of priorities, you know. Do we need to really work that 60, 70, 80-hour week to earn a little bit more money to get the bigger house that we can't ever enjoy because we're never at home? I mean, is that really what we want to do with our life? If it is, okay, go for it. But, I mean, we don't want to be one of these people later on in life look back and go, you know, oh, I wasted a lot of my life. In fact, there's maybe some of you seen, there's a very classic thing on the internet about this. I think it was an Australian lady who was a hospice worker for 40 years, and she, over those years, she asked people top regrets of dying people, laid a list of the top five. One of the top five, I think maybe the top one, was regretted working too hard. Every single patient she had, male patient, she said, every single one regretted working too hard. Too many hours at work, not enough time with family, children and other priorities. We don't want to be like that. So that's why if we reflect on some of these things, we can prioritize our life. Because unfortunately, people don't reflect on this and they think, okay, I need to meditate. Okay, I need to cut that out, that. And then it's always a struggle because we're wanting to do that because it gives us some pleasure or something. So we're forcing, you know, always this back and forth, back and forth. But if we reflect on this, dukkha, we're going to look at these extra things we fill up our life with and we're going to see they're not bringing me anything. I'm not interested. Like, particularly people who had near-death experiences, they often, because of seeing that, they look at these things after and they go, this is meaningless. And they just could not be bothered wasting their life on that stuff. So you'll find with near-death experience people, they often simplify their life dramatically, only focus on important, essential things. So if we do some of this, we don't need to have a near-death experience. We reflect on this, we can have the same point. We can see this, and this is just a complete waste of time. I'm not going to bother with it and do something meaningful. Then suddenly we've got time and energy to meditate. We do some shamatha practice, whatever we can manage. And suddenly we start to get a little bit better. And then suddenly we think, oh, I can do this short retreat now, and then we benefit more. And then we start to really gain some benefit and we think, okay, now I don't really need to have a full-time job. In fact, I can take 6 months off work. I'm going to go and do a six-month retreat now, and then that may bring us to some other level. But, you know, this is how we need to go. Otherwise, of course, we're never going to have any time to do it and we think it's hopeless because I can't achieve that goal. No? Okay. Anything else on those? Yeah.
Yeah, just I get what you're saying and the certainly importance of shamatha meditation and getting that taste and experience. I'm just wondering about, you know, some of the other teachings in the Lam Rim, and I'm just wondering whether a lot of this is about us actually experiencing in life. Like we get the intellectual knowledge and we go out and try it, and of course some things work out all right, some things don't. Then we go back on the meditation cushion. So we're going backwards and forwards, developing it from that. So
exactly.
It's just that hasn't been mentioned. So
that's coming this afternoon. Okay. That's my last session. I'll talk about integration because, again, this is a very important point. You know, often you get, you know, amongst Buddhist people and you hear two people speaking and one person says to the other, oh, when do you do your practice? And the other person says, oh, I do it every morning at 6:30 for an hour. If this is our idea of practice, forget it. Because, you know, yes, if you diligently meditate for an hour every morning, but then you jump off your cushion and run around like you normally do with a chaotic, neurotic mind the rest of the day, whatever little benefit we received in the hour will get crushed by 14 hours of stress and running around. So practice is, exact as you said, meditation and integration. You need to do both. Otherwise, forget it. But if you don't meditate, you're going to find it almost impossible to integrate, to bring it from intellectual to this. So if we get this in meditation, then it's easier to bring it into the day and work on it during the day, which will feed back in, and eventually we'll get to this. So you need both. Otherwise, if you just try to implement without meditating, or you just meditate and you don't integrate, I think you're not really going to get very far. Yeah, that's coming this afternoon, last session. Okay. So what I'd like to do now then is move on to the third insight, the fourth insight. So remember we said that the distortions we need to overcome are these four. So we've looked now in the Theravada, they're really addressing the first three, to realize impermanence, dukkha, and no self. But what I'd like to do now is look at this, how to overcome this, which is really the core of the Mahayana traditions, that if we come to realize there's no independent me, no independent world, that's the fundamental ignorance. If we can realize that, we'll overcome mental affliction, suffering, we can achieve nirvana and eventually enlightenment. So here we're talking about what's called independent existence. That there appears to be an independent me here and an independent objective world there. This is described in Buddhism using some different terms. The first term, and the one you most commonly hear, particularly in the Tibetan tradition, is the word inherent existence. The word inherent existence has the idea of things being self-existent, existing within themselves, having their own unique nature of being that thing. So it seems like the world is made up of many separate, discrete things. So this is what the word inherent existence really means, self-existent, existing within themselves. Another term that's commonly used is things existing from their own side or existing from its own side. So this has the idea of things existing without the need of an observer. That this glass, for example, exists from its own side. It doesn't need me to be here for it to exist. That, you know, that when we walk in the door, there's already a glass sitting here on the table, existing completely from its own side. So that's what this term means. And the last term that's used quite commonly is true existence. Now, generally in English language, something is true if it doesn't deceive us. Things appear to exist independent of us. If they really existed like that, they would be true. Meaning the way in which they appear and the way in which they exist matches. So true existence simply means existing in the same way in which it appears. So that's true existence. So these are all three terms that mean independent existence. There are other terms used, but these are probably the three most common terms used to describe independent existence. Of course, here in the Mahayana, the assertion is that things are not inherently existent, they do not exist from their own side, they do not truly exist. That the way in which things appear and the way in which they exist don't match. That things do not exist in the way they appear. That's the assertion here. So the assertion is really so it's often stated in this way, that things are empty of inherent existence, or another way of saying this, of course, is things are not independently existent because they are dependently existent. So the term in Buddhism there is that things are dependent arisings. Arising here means coming into existence. That things come into existence dependently. So here, this term, things are empty of inherent existence, means things are not independently existent because they are dependently existent. So this term here, empty of inherent existence, this is emptiness. Or in Sanskrit, shunyata. So emptiness doesn't mean nothing really exists. Emptiness simply means things are empty of, or they lack independent existence. They lack inherent existence. They do not exist from their own side. They're not truly existent. So that's what emptiness means. Things are not independently existent. They're empty of existing in that way. Why? Because they exist dependently. So to understand really what this emptiness means, it's very helpful to understand the flip side, that things are dependent. So what we're going to do now is have a look at how are things dependently existent. And if we can understand that, that's going to be very helpful in understanding what emptiness really means. Because often when people see this, they end up misinterpreting this to think, oh, that means everything, nothing exists. But that's not true. So let's have a look at what emptiness really means by looking at what does it mean for things to be dependently existent. The first way in which things are dependently existent or come into existence dependently is they depend on causes and conditions. For example, this laptop here exists depending on causes and conditions. One of the first conditions necessary, of course, someone needs to think about designing this. And then, of course, all the raw materials needed to be gathered, all the various components needed to be manufactured, and then all those various components needed to be assembled. And then, of course, all the people and factories and so forth involved in that process, also necessary. So all of those causes and conditions are necessary for us to have this laptop here today. So I think that's fairly straightforward, common sense. Things also exist depending on their parts. This laptop exists depending on its parts, the metal casing, the screen, the keyboard, the battery, the electronic components. Without all of those parts, there would be no laptop here. So again, I think that's fairly straightforward. But what we're saying, remember here, is because things are dependent, they're empty of inherent existence. They do not exist independently. So our understanding that things are dependent should be overturning the idea that things are independent. But I think for many of us, most of us probably, we're quite happy to accept that this laptop exists depending on causes and conditions and parts, yet, at the same time, we're also happy to accept that when we walk in that door, there's a laptop sitting here on the table already, existing from its own side. Is that true?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That shouldn't be possible, according to this logic, should it? So what's wrong? What it is that we only understand these ideas at a very superficial level. To understand these at a deeper level, what they really mean at a deeper level, we have to go to the third way in which things are dependent. That things exist depending on imputation, labeling, designation, conception. All these terms mean the same thing. So if you understand one of those words, you understand all of them. They mean the same thing. So when we look at that, we might think, I know what that means. It means there's a single thing here which we call laptop. Again, that's a fairly superficial understanding. To understand what we really mean by this, we can understand that when we look out on the world, we're just receiving a mass of sense data, particularly visual data, mass of it. And to make sense out of this, we have to make sense or meaning out of all of this data, otherwise we couldn't function in the world. So what we do is we group various collections of data together and create an object by effectively drawing a line around a collection and say, that's one object. And we have to do this to make sense or meaning out of the world. Otherwise we couldn't function. But we need to do more than that because we live not in this world in isolation, we live with others. To be able to communicate, we have to give names to the things we've created so we can communicate. So imputation, labeling, designation, conception is the whole process of drawing a line, of creating an object, and then giving a name. Already when we've drawn the line, we've done this. Giving the name is just something a little bit extra to so we can communicate. How we divide up the world is not fixed, it's completely arbitrary, depending on the meaning that we want to get out of the world. For example, how many things are there? Two? Everyone agree?
No.
No? Some people disagree. One? Two? Is there one, two? Is there one star there? Two triangles? Six triangles? Or six triangles and a hexagon? Or a collection of 18 lines? So is there one, two, six, seven, or 18 things there? How many? All of them and none of them. From its own side, none of them. From our side, all of them. We determine how many things are there. We bring the star into existence, the two triangles into existence. They do not exist from their own side, independent of our conceptual framework. That's what the third point means. We create the world of objects through drawing lines, giving names. That's what the third point means. And again, we need to do this, otherwise we can't function. So there's no problem with this. The problem is we don't realize we're doing it. And we're going to look at that a little bit later, more in detail. So another way of saying this is that when we hear about this idea of emptiness, we hear the idea that things are not findable. Not findable means in the basis, there is no star to be found there from its own side. We create the star from our side. There's no star there in itself from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework. So that's what it means when Buddhism says things are not findable, meaning there's no object to be found in the basis from its own side. Clear? Okay.
Does it mean not fixed as well?
not fixed. Well, we don't hear that term normally, but another thing, so the other term that you'll hear is... things are merely labelled. Merely labelled. So merely labelled has the same idea that this star only exists within our conceptual framework. There's no star to be found there from its own side. It merely exists through our drawing a line and creating the object and giving the name. That's what merely labelled means. Now, based on that very basic understanding of what the third term means of merely labelled, what I'd like to do now then is, based on this understanding, before we go for lunch, is have a look at what does causes and conditions and parts mean based on this understanding, to try to understand this at a deeper level. So this is a timeline, this is a seed, and this is a sprout or plant that it produces. So we say that the plant exists depending on causes and conditions. Cause is the seed. Conditions, of course, is all the other things necessary, soil, sunlight, water, and so forth. So to have a plant, we need the cause, the seed, and all the conditions of soil, sunlight, and so forth. Straightforward. The question is, though, when does the seed become the plant? At what point in this process does the seed become the plant? Now, if things exist from their own side, independent of us, it should be a fixed, obvious point where the seed becomes the plant. So where does the seed become the plant? Anyone tell me? Doesn't the seed become the plant at the point where this configuration of data stops looking like our concept of seed and starts looking like our concept of plant? Isn't that the point where it becomes the plant? And we all have slightly different concepts of seed and plant, so for some of us the point is here, some of us here, some of us here. We decide when the plant comes into existence. Another point here that can help be helpful. We say that the seed and plant are in a cause-effect relationship. And by definition, if two things are in a cause-effect relationship, they cannot exist simultaneously, by definition. The question is, does the seed cease existing before the plant comes into existence? So think about it first. Again, the question is, does the seed cease or stop existing before the plant comes into existence? There's only two possibilities, yes or no. Which is it?
No.
If you say no, it means the seed exists at the same time as the plant. By definition, impossible. So no is illogical. It's illogical. If you say yes, the seed has ceased to exist, where's the plant coming from? Yes is illogical. Both no and yes are illogical. So our common sense idea of cause and effect based on independent existence is completely illogical. It cannot function. It can't work. So Nagarjuna, the great Indian master of the second century, who's considered to be the founder of the Majjhimika philosophical system, which is the basis of this emptiness idea, he has 27 chapters in his classic text called Mula Majjhimika Karika, Fundamental Wisdom and Middle Way. He has 27 chapters of arguments like this. You believe in independent existence? What about cause and result? How does that work? How does agent and action work? How does fire and fuel, how do these things work? And then we look at them, and they just don't make sense anymore. So these arguments help us to really get rid of the idea that independent existence, that things are independent existent. If we except that things are merely labelled, we don't have this logical absurdity. We're simply changing the label. No problem. But whenever we whenever we turn our lines that we draw into boundaries, if we see the world as made up of separate, discrete things, then all of these ideas of cause and result and so forth don't make sense anymore. It's not possible. Another point here, we say that the result, the plant, depends on the cause, the seed. But this view is saying that the cause depends on the result as well. How does a cause depend on the result? No. I mean, it does, but that's not the answer.
If there wasn't a result, then it'd be impossible to have a cause.
In what sense?
Well, if a cause exists, it must have a result, otherwise it's not a cause.
Well, yes. Basically, you can't call something a cause without having the idea result. You can't call something a seed unless you have the idea of plant. Whether or not it produces it is relevant. But simply to call something a seed or a cause implies result or plant. So that's how cause depends on result. They're mutually, interdependently related. Okay, one more point is in terms of parts. And to do this, I need a... Well, maybe this will work. Yeah. We say that the pen exists depending on its parts. But is there a pen to be found here in the basis? Is this a pen? Nope. Is this a pen? No. Is this a pen? No. Is the tube a pen? Is the ink, well, there's not much ink left, but is the ink a pen? Is the plastic piece a pen? Is the metal ball a pen? Where's the pen? And people go, oh, that's easy. It's the collection of that stuff. Okay. Here's a collection. Is that a pen? Oh, no. It's got to be in a certain shape. So you have to tell me when the pen comes into existence, okay? I want to know. No one's biting yet.
Conform the function.
What about that? Ah, exactly. That's exactly the answer. When does a pen come into existence? We decide. When this configuration of data closely enough resembles our concept of pen. And our concepts usually have at least two parts, appearance and functionality. So when this configuration of data closely enough resembles our appearance of what our concept of pen, and it seems to function according to our concept of pen, then there's a pen, not before. If the pen exists from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework, it would mean if a caveman walked in the door here, they would see a pen and they'd start writing with it. Or if a dog walked in the door, they'd also see pen. But I think if a caveman came in the door, they may see some sort of weapon to stab something with. And if a dog came in the door, they'd probably see some sort of chewing stick. And if a tiny ant came here, they may see some home to live in. So is this a pen, a weapon, a chewing stick, or a home? It's all of them from the side of the observer. It's none of them from the side of the object. So there's no pen existing from its own side. So this is what we mean by things being merely labeled, merely imputed. One very last thing, and then it's time for lunch. We say that the pen depends on its parts. The whole depends on the parts, yeah? But this view is also saying the part depends on the whole. How does the part depend on the whole?
Same way as the long and short of day and night.
Well, the same way as the causes and results, yeah. Is that you can't call something a part of a pen without the idea pen. Whether or not there exists a pen is irrelevant. And then one last statement, then we really go for lunch, is normally we say that the pen exists from its own side. And unfortunately, our language supports that, reinforces that. Don't we normally say this is a pen? As if the pen is the collection of the parts? But this view is saying that's false. So simply even using the terminology, this is a pen, is reinforcing that. Correctly, what we should be saying is, pen is something I'm labelling dependent on this collection of parts, or dependent on this stuff. So the pen is not the collection of the parts. The pen is merely labelled depending on the collection of the parts. If we can understand those two statements are not saying the same thing, we're starting to understand something about emptiness. Okay? So that's a little introduction into emptiness.
Could you almost say this is called a pen?
Yeah.
This is a pen.
But even saying this means one object. So even, it's better.
Yeah.
This is a pen versus this is called a pen. That's sort of the superficial. There's a thing here I'm calling a pen. That's better than this is a pen. But better is pen is something I'm labelling on the collection of this stuff. That's better.
Yeah.
Way, yeah? So...
What changes it from a noun to a verb, like penning? He says there is a penning.
Also that's a sort of partial sort of answer. Because that can also reinforce the process.
Is it that the problem is with names themselves?
No, the problem is not the name. Here's the problem. Is there's the basis here, and this is continually changing. Yeah, we know that. Science has proven it. So we have a continually changing basis, impermanence. We have label pen. The label pen is very static, isn't it? It doesn't change, the label pen. Our concept could be refined, but the label pen is a static thing. And we're applying that to the basis, which is, we need to do that. Otherwise, we can't function. The problem is, we don't realise we are applying that to the basis. We are what's called fusing them, cognitive fusion. We are fusing the label and the basis together and saying they're one thing. This is a pen. That's the problem. And that's why also it reinforces our idea that pens are stable and static, because the label is stable and static. So, again, we have to apply the label to the basis to communicate, but the problem is we don't realise that's what's going on. We fuse them together and say, this is a pen. That's the problem. That's ignorance. So on that note, let's have some lunch and come back at 1:30, and then we'll have a look at how to meditate on this idea of emptiness, and then finally how to integrate it into our life.